Shrine Skekken Archer had already circled the palace twice, primarily to scope out potential problems at the South Gate entrance, where the prearranged meet was supposed to take place. Shrine found it interesting that Czar's ostensible reason for making a low-key departure was to keep from involving Organa in his problems. But Shrine wasn't clear on just what those problems were. Both Czar and Organa had been outspoken members of the Loyalist Committee, so what could Czar have done to cause problems for himself that didn't already involve Organa? Was he in a fix with Palpatine? Shrine tried to convince himself that Czar's troubles were none of his business, that the sooner he accustomed himself to simply executing a job, the better, for him and for Jula. This, as opposed to thinking like a Jedi, which involved looking to the Force as a means of gauging possible repercussions and ramifications of his actions. In that sense, the Alderaan mission was the first day of the rest of his life. Olee Starstone was the only other issue he had to clear from his mind. In response to Shrine's decision to follow his own path, she was about as angry as a Jedi was allowed to be, though some of the other Jedi had said that they understood. All seven had taken the battered transport and gone in search of surviving Jedi. Shrine feared it would just be a matter of time before they got themselves in serious trouble, but he wasn't about to serve as their watchdog. More to the point, they had seen the risks they were taking as flowing from the will of the Force. Well, who knew for sure? Shrine wasn't omniscient. Maybe they would succeed against all odds. Maybe the Jedi, in league with political protesters and sympathetic military commanders, could bring Palpatine to justice for what he had done. Unlikely, but a possibility nevertheless. Jula had been generous enough to loan Philly to the Jedi, outwardly to help them sort through the data they downloaded from the Beacon databases. Shrine suspected, however, that Jula's real intent was to disable Starstone's reckless determination. Through his comlink's wireless earpiece, Shrine heard Jula's voice.
I just heard from our bundle. He's in motion.
We're working our way around to him now, Shrine said into the audio pickup, fastened to the synth fur collar of his coat.
You sure you're going to be able to recognize him from the holo images?
Recognizing him won't be a problem, but finding him in this crowd could be.
I'm guessing he didn't expect this big a turnout.
I'm guessing no one did.
Does that say something for the Emperor's days being numbered?
Someone's days, anyway. Shrine paused, then said, Hold for a moment. The palace's South Gate entrance was within sight now, but in the time it had taken Shrine, Skekken, Archer to complete their third circuit, a mob had formed. Three human speakers, standing atop repulsor-lit platforms, were urging everyone to press through the tall gates and onto the palace grounds. Anticipating trouble, a group of 40 or so royal troops, dressed in ceremonial armor and slack hats, had deployed themselves outside the gates, armed with an array of non-lethal crowd control devices, including sonic devices, shock batons, and stun nets.
Roan, what's going on?
Jula asked. Things are getting rowdy. Everyone's being warned away from the South Gate entrance. The crowd surged, and Shrine felt himself lifted from his feet and carried toward the palace. The cordon of troops issued a final warning. When the crowd surged again, two frontline guards, sporting backpack rigs, began to coat the cobblestone plaza with a thick layer of repellent foam. The crowd surged back in response, but dozens of demonstrators closest to the front failed to step back in time and were immediately immobilized in the rapidly spreading goo. A few of them were able to retreat by surrendering their foot gear, but the rest were stuck fast. Shrine began to edge toward the perimeter, with Skekken Archer to either side of him. When he could, he enabled his comlink.
Jula, we're not going to be able to get to the gate.
Which also means that our bundle won't be able to exit the grounds that way.
Do we have a substitute rendezvous?
Roan, I've lost voice contact with him.
Probably temporary. When you hear from him, just tell him to stay put wherever he is.
Where will you be?
Shrine studied the palace's curved south wall.
Don't worry. We'll find a way in.
those poor beings trapped in that terrible foam.
C-3PO said, as he and R2-D2 hastened for a narrow access door in the palace's south wall. Close to the palace's underground droid maintenance facility, where both droids had enjoyed an oil bath, the door was the same one they'd used to exit the palace grounds earlier that day, when the protesters were just beginning their march.
I think we'll be much better off inside the palace.
R2-D2 chittered a response. C-3PO tilted his head in bafflement.
What do you mean we've been ordered inside anyway? Ordered to conceal ourselves? By whom? Captain Antilles? How thoughtful of him to show concern for our well-being in the midst of this confusion.
By then, they'd reached the access door in the wall. R2-D2 extended a slender interface arm from one of the compartments in his squat, cylindrical torso, and was in the process of inserting it into a computer control terminal alongside the doorway, when the voice of a flesh and blood said, "Misplace your starfighter, droid!" Turning completely about, C-3PO found himself looking at a human and two six-fingered humanoids wearing long coats and tall boots. The human's left hand was patting R2-D2's dome of a head.
Oh, who are you?
Never mind that, one of the humanoids said.
Parting his coat, he revealed a blaster wedged into the wide belt that cinched his pants.
Do you know what this is?
R2-D2 mewled in distress. C-3PO's photoreceptors refocused.
Why, yes, it's a DL-13 ion blaster.
The humanoid smiled nastily.
You're very learned.
Sir, it is my fondest wish that my master recognizes much. Working with other droids has become so tiresome.
Ever see what an ionizer on full power can do to a droid?
The humanoid interrupted.
No, but I can well imagine.
Good, the human said. Then here's the way it's going to work. You're going to lead us into the palace like we're all the best of friends.
Vader stood at the foot of the shuttle's boarding ramp, gazing at the white spires of the royal palace. Commander Appo and six of his stormtroopers spread out to flank him as Bail Organa and several others emerged from the ornate building. For a moment, neither group moved. Then Organa's contingent walked onto the landing platform and approached the shuttle.
You are Lord Vader? Organa asked.
Senator,
Vader said, inclining his head slightly.
I demand to know why you've come to Alderaan.
Senator, you are in no position to demand anything.
Organa introduced him to his aides and advisors, as well as to Captain Antilles, who commanded Alderaan's Corellian-made consular ship, and who tried, but failed, to conceal an expression of profound hostility toward Vader.
If Antilles only knew who he was dealing with.
From beyond the palace's walls came the sound of angry voices and chanting. Vader surmised that at least some of the turbulence owed to the presence of an Imperial shuttle on Alderaan. The thought entertained him. Vader listened to the sounds of the crowd for a moment more, then turned to regard Organa.
Why do you permit this?
Organa's restless eyes searched for something, perhaps a peek at the man behind the mask.
Are such demonstrations no longer permitted on Coruscant?
Harmony is the ideal of the New Order, Senator, not dissension.
When harmony becomes the standard for all, then protests will cease. What's more, by allowing voices to be heard here, Alderaan saves Coruscant any unmerited embarrassment.
There may be some truth to that, but in due time, protests will cease. One way or another.
Vader recognized that Organa was in a quandary about something. Clearly, he resented being challenged on his own world, but his tone of voice was almost conversational.
I trust that the Emperor knows better than to end them by fear, he was saying.
The Emperor would not be pleased by your lack of faith, Senator,
he said carefully.
Or by your willingness to allow others to display their distrust. But I haven't come to discuss your little march.
Organa fingered his short beard. What does bring you here?
former Senator Fang Zhar.
Organa seemed genuinely surprised. What of him?
Then you don't deny that he's here?
Of course not. He has been a guest of the palace for several weeks.
Are you aware that he fled Coruscant?
Organa frowned in uncertainty. It sounds as if you're suggesting that he wasn't permitted to leave of his own free will. Was he under arrest?
Not arrest, Senator. Internal security had questions for him, some of which were left unanswered. ISB requested that he remain in Imperial Center until matters were resolved.
Organa shook his head once. I knew nothing of this.
No one is questioning your decision to house him, Senator.
Vader said, gazing down at him.
I simply want your assurance that you won't interfere with my escorting him back to Coruscant.
Back to? Organa left the rest of it unfinished and began again. I won't interfere. Except in one instance. Vader waited. If Senator Zhar requests diplomatic immunity, Alderaan will grant it. Vader folded his arms across his chest.
I'm not certain that privilege still exists. Even if it does, you may find that refusing the Emperor's request is hardly in your best interest.
A nearby holo projector chimed, and from it emerged the holo image of a dark-haired woman with an infant in her arms.
Bail, I'm sorry I've been delayed,
the woman said.
I just wanted to let you know that I'll be there shortly.
Organa looked from Vader to the holo image and back again. As the image faded, he said, Perhaps it's better if you spoke with Senator Zhar in person. He gulped and found his voice. I'll have him escorted to the conference room as soon as possible. Vader turned and waved a signal to Commander Apo, who nodded.
Who is the woman?
Vader asked Organa. My wife, Organa said nervously. The Queen. Vader regarded Organa, trying to read him more clearly.
Inform Senator Zhar that I'm waiting. In the meantime, I would enjoy meeting the Queen.
More than 7 centuries old, the palace was a rambling and multi-storied affair of ramparts and turrets, bedrooms and ballrooms, with as many grand stairways as it had turbo lifts. Without a map, its kilometers of winding corridors were nearly impossible to follow. And so, we're walking from the droid maintenance room to the hallway that accessed the South Gate had seemed a simple matter. It was in fact akin to negotiating a maze.
The droid's more clever than it looks,
Archer said, when it finally dawned on them that the two machine intelligences had been walking them in circles for the past quarter hour.
I think it's leading us on a wild Gundark chase.
Oh, he would never do that, C-3PO said. Would you, R2?
When the astromech didn't answer, C-3PO slammed his hand down on R2-D2's dome.
Don't you even think about giving me the silent treatment!
Shrine brought the five of them to an abrupt halt. This isn't the way to the south entrance. Where are we? C-3PO gazed around.
I believe that we have somehow ended up in the royal residence wing.
Archer's pointed jaw dropped.
What the frizz are we doing here? We're 180 degrees from where we want to be.
Skek aimed the ionizer at the astromech's photoreceptor.
You can navigate a starfighter through hyperspace and you can't get us to the South Gate?
Any more tricks and we're going to fry you.
Shrine stepped away from everyone and activated his comlink. Jula, any word from...
Where in the galaxy have you three been? I've been trying to reach you for...
We got turned around, Shrine said. We'll fix it. Any word from our bundle?
That's what I wanted to tell you. He moved.
Where to?
The East Gate.
Shrine blew out his breath.
All right, we'll get there. Just make sure you tell him to remain where he is.
Silencing the comlink, he rejoined the others.
East Gate?
Skek said, when Shrine relayed the bad news. He turned himself through a circle and pointed.
That way, I think. The astromech began to chitter. Shrine and the others looked to C-3PO for a translation.
He says, sirs, that the quickest route to the East Gate will involve our ascending one more level.
We're supposed to be going down, Archer said in exasperation.
That's true. But my counterpart advises that unless we go up first, we will be forced to detour around the upper reaches of the Grand Ballroom Atrium.
Enough, Shrine said, ending further argument. Let's just get this over with. With the astromech leading, rolling along on its three treads, the five of them filed into a turbo lift and rode it up one floor. No sooner had they arrived than R2-D2 made a sudden left into the stately corridor and hurried off.
What? All of a sudden it's in a rush?
Archer said.
R2, slow down!
C-3PO called, struggling to keep up. The astromech disappeared around a bend in the corridor. Skek muttered a curse and drew the ionizer again.
I think it's trying to get away!
The three of them began to race after their quarry, dashing around the same corner, only to narrowly avoid colliding with a regally dressed woman cradling a sleeping baby in her arms. Stopping suddenly, the astromech loosed an ear-piercing screech and extended half a dozen of its interface arms, waving them about like weapons. Confronted with the sight, the woman pulled the baby closer to her with one hand, while the other reached out to slap a security alarm stud set into the wall. Rudely awakened by the astromech screech and the blare of alarms, the baby took a quick look at the droid and began wailing at the top of its lungs. Exchanging the briefest of panicked looks, Shrine, Archer, and Skek about-faced and ran. Bale's assured posture in one of the reception room's elegant chairs belied his sense of raw desperation. A few meters away, standing at one of the tall windows, Darth Vader gazed out on crowds of demonstrators who were becoming more turbulent with every passing moment. This is Leia's father, Bale told himself, certain of it now. Anakin Skywalker, rescued somehow on Mustafar and returned to life, though now confined to a suit that made manifest what Skywalker had become at the end of the war. Betrayer, butcher of children, apprentice of Sidious, follower of the dark side of the Force. And soon, Leia would be in his presence. When Breha had comlinked him unexpectedly, Bale had come close to telling her to flee, fully prepared to suffer whatever consequences would descend on him. To ensure Leia's safety, he had even been ready to sacrifice Fang Zar. Would Vader recognize Leia through the Force as his child? What would happen if he did? Would he compel Bale to reveal where Obi-Wan was, where Luke was? No, Bale would die first.
What's taking Senator Zar so long?
Vader asked. Bale had his mouth open to reply that the palace guest wing was some distance away, when Sheltray Retrack entered the reception room, her expression alone making it clear that something was wrong. Approaching Bale, she leaned low to say in a quiet voice, Fang Zar is not in the residence. We don't know where he is. Before Bale could reply, Vader swung to the two of them.
Was Zar alerted of my coming?
Bale came to his feet quickly. No one was apprised beforehand of the reason for your visit. Vader glanced at Commander Appo.
Find him, Commander, and bring him to me.
The words had scarcely left the black grill that concealed Vader's mouth, then security alarms began to sound throughout the palace. Captain Antilles immediately moved into the transmission field of the reception room's holoprojector, where a half-life-size image of a security officer was already resolving.
Sir, three unidentified beings have gained access to the palace. Their motive is unknown, but they are armed and were last seen in the residential wing in the company of two droids.
Do we have images of the intruders? Retrack asked before Bale could silence her.
Only of the intruders,
the security officer said.
Show them, Antilles ordered.
The security cam image showed three males, one human and two humanoids, dashing down one of the corridors.
Jedi,
Vader said, mostly to himself. Jedi? That can't be possible. Vader whirled on him.
They've come for Fang Zar.
He stared at Bail from inside the mask.
Zar is attempting to return to Cern Prime. Apparently, he hoped to keep from implicating you in his flight.
The reception room fell silent, but only for a moment. From the holoprojector appeared an image of Breha, holding a distraught Leia in her arms.
Bail, I won't be joining you after all,
she said, loud enough to be heard over the infant's crying.
We had a disturbing encounter with three trespassers and a couple of droids, who nearly frightened the baby to death. She's in no condition to be introduced to company. I'm trying to calm her.
That's probably best, Bail said in a rush. I'll check back with you in a moment. Deactivating the holoprojector, he turned slowly to Vader, arranging his features to suggest a mix of mild disappointment at his wife's message and deep concern for just about everything else that had occurred. I'm certain there'll be another time, Lord Vader.
I look forward to it.
With that, he turned and marched away.
If I ever run into that astromech again, Skek said as he, Archer, and Shrine were racing for the palace's east entrance.
Archer nodded in agreement.
Never a good feeling when you're tricked by an appliance.
His comlink enabled, Shrine was speaking with Jula.
We're almost there, but that's no guarantee we can make it outside without being arrested.
Roan, I'm going to reposition the ship. Close to our rendezvous, there's a landing platform reserved for HoloNet correspondence.
We'll see you there, Shrine said. Out!
With the ornate east entrance in sight, the three of them slowed down to survey the situation. A pair of enormous doors opened on a broad staircase. From the last step, a paved footpath led to an arched bridge that spanned a crescent of reflecting pool. On the far side of the pool, the path led directly to a gated access in the high rampart. Perhaps 100 meters beyond the wall was the media landing platform Jula had mentioned. Shrine scanned the beings assembled on the narrow bridge and the green lawn between it and the rampart. Ultimately, his gaze found a short, dark-complexioned man with a shock of long white beard.
That's Zar, he said, pointing out the senator to Skek and Archer. And here comes trouble, Skek said, indicating four royal guards who were hurrying for the gate, rifles slung over their shoulders.
We need to make our move, Archer said, before any more of them show up.
Skek parted his long coat, reached around to the small of his back, and drew a blaster.
So much for pulling this off without a hitch.
Shrine placed his right hand on the weapon while Skek was checking the power level.
You might not have to use it. Those long rifles are no match for even a hand blaster, and the guards know it. Besides, they probably haven't fired a round since the last royal funeral.
Yeah, but can I quote you on that? Skek said.
Shrine took a step toward the doors, froze, then retreated, pressing himself to the wall. Archer regarded him in bafflement.
What are you?
Vader, Shrine managed. Vader hunted the hallways of the palace, the suit's array of sensors enhancing every sound and smell, every stray movement, his heavy cloak hooked around the hilt of his lightsaber. Sensing a subtle presence, he stopped. At the same time, someone behind him shouted,
Vader!
Igniting his lightsaber, Vader turned completely around. Hands by his sides, Shrine stood at the intersection of two corridors, one of which led to the palace's east portal, the other to the ballroom.
So you're the bait,
Vader said after a moment.
It's an old ploy, Shrine. A ploy I've used. And it won't work this time.
I have a backup plan. Shrine flourished the blaster. Vader focused on the weapon.
I see that you've abandoned your lightsaber.
But not my commitment to justice.
Shrine took a moment to glance down the hallway that led out of the palace.
You know how it is, Vader. Once a good guy, always a good guy. Then again, you probably don't know anything about that.
Vader advanced on him.
Don't be too sure of yourself.
We're just trying to help Zar get home, Shrine said, retreating into the corridor. Suppose we leave it at that.
The Emperor has his reasons for recalling Zar to Coruscant.
And you do whatever the Emperor tells you to do? In the intersection now, Vader could discern that Shrine was merely waiting for a chance to bolt through the doors. Well behind Shrine, on the far side of a footbridge that crossed the gentle curve of reflecting pool, one of Shrine's armed accomplices was holding four royal guards at bay, while the other was all but dragging Fang Zar toward a gated breach in the palace's defensive wall, beyond which the conspirators surely had a getaway craft waiting. Shrine fired a quick burst, then sprinted for the doorway. Behind him, his humanoid accomplices were also in motion, stunning the guards to unconsciousness and racing for the open gate. Angling his blade, Vader deflected the bolts with intent, but by jinking and jagging, Shrine managed to evade each parry. Vader leapt, his powerful prosthetic legs carrying him to the top of a broad but short flight of steps, in time to see Shrine sprint across the bridge at Jedi speed, motioning to his accomplices to move Zar through the gate. Vader leapt again, this time to the bridge and to within only a few meters of Shrine, who spun about, dropping to one knee and firing repeatedly. This time, Vader decided to show Shrine whom he was dealing with. Holding his lightsaber to one side, he raised his right hand to turn the blaster bolts. Clearly astonished, Shrine remained on one knee, but only briefly. In an instant, he'd passed through the gate and was shouldering his way through the crowd outside the wall. Vader's final leap landed him just short of the rampart. Over the heads of the milling beings, at the forward edge of a landing platform, a woman with gray-laced black hair was gesturing frantically to Shrine and his cohorts, who were already hauling Fang Zar up the platform steps. All too easy, Vader told himself. Time to end it. Bail and his two aides stood by the reception room holoprojector, awaiting some word of Fang Zar's whereabouts. From the direction of the residence wing came Antilles and the droids. Go ahead, 3PO. Tell him, Antilles said, when the three of them were within earshot of Bail.
Master Organa, I only wanted to report that the three intruders who held us captive were apparently intent on collecting some sort of bundle, that was the word they used, at the palace's east gate.
Quickly, Bail said to his aides. Aldreet bent to adjust the holoprojector's controls. An instant later, an east gate security cam captured a holo image of Fang Zar, seized in the grip of two humanoids who were running him toward a landing platform that had been designated for holonet personnel. A second cam found Vader, crimson-bladed lightsaber in hand, fending off blaster fire from a long-haired human male who was also racing for the east gate.
Sir?
Sheltray Retrax said suddenly. Bail saw Sate Pestage striding into the reception room.
Senator, I have just learned that Senator Zar is at this moment being conducted from the palace,
Pestage said.
I demand that you secure the palace before it's too late.
Bail glanced at the hollow images of Vader, the long-haired man, Fang Zar.
Seal it, I tell you.
Bail took a final glance at the images, then complied. Firing on the run, Shrine made a mad dash for the rampart gate. If his retreat struck Skek or Archer or even Fang Zar as cowardly, then so be it. For it was clear that Vader wasn't going to be stopped by blaster bolts, and Shrine was a long way from the nearest lightsaber. Shrine wasn't surprised that Vader knew him by name. That he did only reinforced the fact that Vader and the Emperor had full access to the Jedi Temple databases. For all Shrine knew, Vader had been at the temple when Philly Bitters had sliced into the beacon. Outside the gate now, he began to zigzag through the densely packed crowd. Catching sight of his weapon, many of the marchers hastened to open a path for him, an obvious berserker in their midst.
Through gaps in the throng, Shrine could see Skek, Archer, Jula, and Zar on the landing platform, surrounded by what Shrine took to be irate Holonet correspondents yelling at them and gesticulating to the dropship that had set down without permission. Judging by her gestures, Jula was attempting to placate everyone, or at least assure them that the ship would soon be on its way, assuming that Vader didn't scuttle their plans with a single leap. Midway up the stairway that led to the landing platform, Shrine came to a halt to take what he hoped would be a last look at Vader, who was still on the palace grounds, a couple of meters shy of the rampart gate. Of greater interest to Shrine, however, was the fact that an alloy curtain, thick as a blast shield, was descending rapidly from the head jamb of the arched entrance. The palace was being sealed shut, and Vader was in risk of not making it through the gate in time. Understanding as much, the Emperor's executioner was moving faster now. A jump carried him to the rampart, just short of the lowering shield, where he did something so unexpected that it took Shrine a moment to make sense of what was happening. Vader hurled his ignited lightsaber through the air. For a split second, Shrine thought that he had done so in anger. Then, in awe, he grasped that Vader had aimed. Spinning out from under the lowering security gate, the crimson blade sailed high over the crowd, following a trajectory that took it north of the landing platform. Then, on reaching the distal end of its arc, it began to boomerang back. Shrine flew for the top of the stairway, his gaze fully engaged on the twirling blade, his heart hammering in his chest. Calling on the Force, he tried to influence the course of the lightsaber, but either the Force wasn't with him, or Vader's Force abilities were overpowering his. The blade was whipping toward the landing platform now, close enough for Shrine to hear it whine through the air, and spinning so swiftly, it might have been a blood-red disc. Passing within a meter of Shrine's outstretched hands, the lightsaber struck Fang Zar first, ripping a deep gouge across his upper chest and nearly decapitating him. Then, continuing on, it struck an unsuspecting Jula across the back before completing its swift and lethal circle and slamming into upper reaches of the fully lowered rampart gate, where it switched off and plummeted to the paving stones with a metallic clangor. On the landing platform, Skek was bent low over Fang Zar, Archer over Jula. Rooted in place, Shrine could sense Vader on the far side of the gate, a black hole of rage. Shrine commenced a stiff-legged descent of the stairway, deaf to all sound, blind to color, scarcely in possession of himself. He didn't come to his senses until he reached the foot of the stairs, where he turned and ran to help get his mother and Zar aboard the dropship. Returned to its astral sanctuary, the drunk dancer drifted in space. From the hatch to medbay, a 2-1B droid hovered out to report that it had been able to save Jula, but that Fang Zar had died on the operating table.
Damage sustained by major vessels that supply the heart were too extensive to repair, sir. Everything that could be done was done.
Shrine looked in on Jula, who was heavily sedated.
I dragged you right back into it, she said weakly.
He pushed her hair off her forehead. There might have been other forces at work.
Don't say that, Roan. We just need to get farther away.
He smiled with effort. I'll ask Archer about outfitting the ship with an intergalactic drive. He let her drift into sleep and went to his bunk. Whenever he shut his eyes, he would see the trajectory of Vader's blade, would see it slicing through Zar, through Jula. He didn't need to shut his eyes to recall how it felt to be overwhelmed by Vader's ability to use the Force, to use the power of the dark side. A Sith. Shrine was certain now. A Sith in service to Emperor Palpatine. That was the revelation he couldn't banish. Count Dooku might as well have won the war, save for the fact that in place of independent systems, free trade, and the rest, the galaxy answered to the exclusive rule of Palpatine. But how? Shrine asked himself How had it happened?
In the antechamber of his private retreat, Sidious, dressed in a dark blue cowled robe, paced in front of the curved window wall. Vader stood rigidly at the center of the room, his gloved hands crossed in front of him.
"It appears you attended to our little problem on Alderaan, Lord Vader," Sidious said.
"Yes, Master. Fang Zar need no longer concern you."
"I know I should feel some sense of relief, but in fact, I'm not entirely pleased with the outcome. Zar's death could arouse sympathy in the Senate."
Vader stirred.
"He left me no recourse."
Sidious came to a halt and turned toward Vader.
"No recourse? Why didn't you simply apprehend him as I asked?"
"He made the mistake of attempting to flee."
"But you against someone like Fang Zar. It hardly seems an equitable match, Lord Vader."
"Zar was not alone,"
Vader said with venom.
"What's more, if you don't like the way..."
Suddenly intrigued, Sidious moved closer.
"Ah, what's this? Allowing your words to trail off, as if I can't see their destination."
Anger showed in his yellow eyes.
"As if I can't see the thought behind them."
Vader said nothing.
"Perhaps you're not enjoying your new station in life, is that it? Perhaps you tire already of executing my commands."
Sidious stared at him.
"Perhaps you think you're better suited to occupy the throne than I am. Is that it, Lord Vader? If so, then admit as much."
Breathing deeply, Vader remained silent for a moment more.
"I am but an apprentice. You are the master."
"Interesting that you refrain from calling me your master."
Vader inclined his head to Sidious.
"I meant nothing by it, my master."
Sidious sneered.
"Perhaps you wish you could strike me down. Is that it?"
"No, Master."
"What stops you from doing so? Obi-Wan was once your master, and you were certainly prepared to kill him, even if you failed."
Vader clenched his right hand.
"Obi-Wan did not understand the power of the dark side."
"And you do?"
"No, Master. Not yet. Not fully."
"And that's why you don't try to strike me down? Because I possess powers you lack?"
Sidious lifted his arms, hands deployed like claws, as if to summon and hurl Sith lightning.
"Because you know that I could easily overwhelm the delicate electrical systems of your suit."
Vader stood his ground.
"I don't fear death, Master."
Sidious grinned maliciously.
"Then why go on living, my young apprentice?"
Vader looked down at him.
"To learn to become more powerful."
Sidious lowered his hands.
"Then I ask you one final time, Lord Vader. Why not strike me down?"
"Because you are the path to power, Master. Because I need you."
Sidious narrowed his eyes and nodded.
"Just like I needed my master, for a time."
"Yes, Master,"
Vader said finally.
"For a time."
"Good. Very good."
Sidious smiled in satisfaction.
"And now you are ready to release your anger."
Vader evinced confusion.
"Your fugitive Jedi, my apprentice,"
Sidious said.
"They are traveling to Kashyyyk."
He tipped his head to one side.
"Perhaps, Lord Vader, they hope to lay a trap for you."
Vader clenched his hands.
"That would be my most fervent wish, my master."
Sidious clamped his hands on Vader's upper arms.
"Then go to them, Lord Vader. Make them sorry they didn't hide while they had the chance."
Part 4. Kashyyyk. Inside the battered transport that had once belonged to an Imperial garrison on Dalalt, Olise Starstone and the six Jedi who joined her crusade waited to be granted clearance to continue onto Kashyyyk space. The commanders of the half-dozen Imperial corvettes that made up the inspection point picket answered not to distant Coruscant, but to the regional governor headquartered on Bimisari. The Jedi had done all they could to make the ship look the part of a military surplus transport. Thanks mostly to Jula's crew, the drives had been tweaked to produce a new signature. The ship's profile had been altered, the defensive shields and countermeasures suite repaired. To ensure that what remained conformed to Imperial standards, many of the advanced sensors and scanners had been eliminated, along with most of the laser cannons. The Drunk Dancer's maintenance droids had given the ship a quick paint job, and it helped remove some of the seats amidships to create a common cabin space. To Starstone, the vessel's fresh look matched the false identities the Jedi had adopted, as well as the clothes that made them look like a motley crew of struggling space merchants. The transport's cockpit was spacious enough to accommodate Starstone and Philly Bitters, in addition to Jambe Lu and Nam Porf, later the Temple's Agricultural Corps, who were doing the piloting, and still sightless Dara Nalual, who was tucked into the cramped communications duty station. No one had said a word since Nalual had transmitted the ship's authorization key to the picket array's Cardinal Corvette. Philly was confident that the transport's altered drive signature would pass muster, but, new to forging Imperial code, he was less certain about the authorization key. Starstone placed her hand on Jambe's shoulder as a way of saying, "Be ready to make a run for it." Jambe was centering himself behind the steering yoke when an officious voice issued from the cockpit speakers.
"Vagabond trader, you are cleared for approach to Kashyyyk. Commerce Control will provide you with vector coordinates for atmospheric entry and landing."
"Understood," Darren said into the mouthpiece of her headset. Engaging the transport's sublight drive, Jambe and Nam began to edge the transport through the cordon. Thus far, the crusade had come to nothing. On every world they'd visited between Felucia and Seleucami, it had been the same. The Jedi had been revealed as traitors to the Republic and had been killed by the clone troopers they'd commanded. None had survived, Starstone and the others had been told. And pity any who had survived, for anti-Jedi sentiment was widespread, especially in the Outer Rim. Among populations that had been drawn into the war and now saw themselves as having been mere performers in a game the Jedi had been playing to assume control of the Republic. Justification for Shrine to say, "I told you so," when they next met. Even in the few standard weeks since the war's end, a dramatic change had taken place. With the rapid diffusion of the symbols of the Empire, fear was radiating from the core. On worlds where peace should have brought relief, distrust and suspicion prevailed. The war was over, and yet brigades of stormtroopers remained garrisoned on hundreds of worlds, formerly Separatist and Republic alike. The war was over, and yet Imperial inspection points dotted the major hyperlanes and sector jump points. The war was over, and yet the call was out for recruits to serve in the Imperial armed forces. The war was over, and yet the Holonet addressed little else. Starstone believed she understood why. Because in the depths of his black heart, the Emperor knew that the next war wouldn't be fought from the outside in, but rather from the inside out. That not a generation would pass, much less the 10,000 years Palpatine had predicted the Empire to endure, before the disease that had now taken root on Coruscant would infect every system in the galaxy. Even so, as desperate as the quest seemed, she was still counting on the Wookiees to provide the Jedi with the hope they needed to carry on. From information gleaned from the Temple Beacon database, they knew that three Jedi had been dispatched to Kashyyyk: Quinlan Vos, Luminara Unduli, and Master Yoda himself, who, according to Forte and Kulka, had enjoyed a long-standing relationship with the Wookiees. If there was a planet where Jedi could have survived Palpatine's execution order,
Kashyyyk would be it. Wookiee world, Nam said, as he dropped the bow of the transport. The planet rose into view, white-capped, otherwise green and blue. Dozens of huge vessels hung in orbit, including the perforated hulks of several Separatist warships. Ferries and dropships could be seen emerging from and disappearing into Kashyyyk's high-stacked clouds. The communications console chimed a repeating series of tones. Vector routing from Commerce Control, Darren said. Make sure they understand we want to set down near Kachirho, Starstone said. Darren nodded. Transmitting our request. Relaying course coordinates to navigation. Nam threw an excited look over his shoulder. I've wanted to visit Kashyyyk for 10 years.
Half the Corps would like to visit Kashyyyk, Philly said. But the Wookiees don't cater to tourists.
What? No luxury accommodations? Jambe said. Philly shook his head.
They might be willing to provide a tent.
How many times have you been here? Starstone asked him. He thought about it, then shrugged.
10, 12.
In between regular jobs, we'd sometimes run scrap technology here.
Can you speak the language?
Nam asked.
Philly laughed. I once met a human who could bark a couple of useful phrases, but the best I could ever manage was a thank you, and that worked only 1 out of 10 times.
Starstone frowned. Do we have a translator droid or some sort of emulator?
We won't need one, Philly said. The Wookiees employ a mixed-species staff of go-betweens to help out with sales and trades.
Who do we ask for? Starstone said.
Philly took a moment. Last time I was here, there was a guy named Cudgel.
The vagabond trader began its descent into Kashyyyk's aromatic atmosphere, light fading as the ship dropped below the canopy of the planet's 300-meter-tall rosher trees into an area of majestic cliffs crowned with vegetation. Adjusting course, Jambe and Nam guided the transport to a lakeshore landing platform made of wood. Towering majestically over the platform and the aquamarine lake rose the city of Kachirho, which consisted of a cluster of giant tiered rochers. In his eagerness to fulfill a 10-year dream, Nam nearly botched the landing, but no one was hurt, despite being tossed about. As soon as everyone had exited the ship, Philly disappeared to find Cudgel. Starstone gazed at the trees and sheer cliffs in wonderment. Her hopes for finding Yoda notwithstanding, the Wookiee world rendered other planets she'd visited prosaic by comparison. She was still gaping like a tourist when Philly returned, accompanied by a thick-set male human dressed in short trousers and a sleeveless shirt. If he wasn't quite as hairy as a Wookiee, it was not for want of trying.
Cudgel, Philly said by way of introduction.
Cudgel smiled at everyone in turn, jocular but clearly dubious, and Starstone immediately saw why. While she and her band of fugitive Jedi could dress the part of merchants, even talk the part, they couldn't stand the part. Literally. Straight-backed, silent, hands clasped in front of them, they looked more like a group of vacationing meditators, which wasn't far from the truth.
First time to Kashyyyk? Cudgel said.
Yes, Starstone answered for everyone. Hopefully not our last.
Welcome, then.
Forcing a smile, he eyed the transport.
This is an L-200, isn't it?
Military surplus, Philly said quickly.
Cudgel cocked a flaring eyebrow.
Already? I was under the impression there wasn't any surplus.
Before Philly could respond, he continued.
Can't be carrying much in the way of trade goods. Are you off a freighter up top?
We're not here to trade, exactly, Philly said. More in the way of a fact-finding mission.
We're in the market for an OVA or catamaran, Starstone explained. Cudgel blinked in surprise.
Then your ship had better be filled with Orodium credits.
Our client is prepared to pay a fair price, Starstone said. Cudgel stroked his chest-length beard.
not a question of price, more of availability. How bad were things here?
Forte asked abruptly.
The battle, I mean.
Cudgel followed the Jedi's gaze to the tree city.
Bad enough. The Wookiees are still cleaning up.
Many killed?
Nam asked. Even one's too many.
Were any Jedi involved? Jambe's question seemed to stop Cudgel cold.
Why do you ask?
We just came from Seleukami, Starstone said, hoping to put Cudgel at ease. We heard that several Jedi were killed by clone troopers during the battle. Cudgel appraised her.
I wouldn't know about that. I was in Rawukararo during most of it, he pointed. The other side of the escarpment.
A short silence fell over everyone.
Well, let's see if I can't find someone who knows catamarans,
Cudgel said at last. Starstone kept quiet until the hirsute middleman had moved off. I don't think that went so well, she said to Forte and the others.
Shouldn't matter,
Ewol Kalka said. Kashyyyk isn't Seleukami or Felucia. We're in Jedi-friendly territory. That's what you said on Baw's Pity, Starstone started to say when Philly cut her off.
Cudgel's back.
With four rangy Wookiees in tow, Starstone saw.
These are the folk I told you about,
Cudgel was telling the Wookiees in basic. Before Starstone could open her mouth to speak, the Wookiees bared their fangs and brandished the most bizarre-looking hand blasters she'd ever seen. The Star Destroyer Exactor and its older sibling Executrix drifted side by side, bow astern, forming a parallelogram of armor and armament. Vader's black shuttle navigated the short distance between them. When the shuttle had docked in the Executrix's hold, Vader led his contingent of stormtroopers out of the vessel, only to find that his host hadn't shown him the courtesy of being on hand to greet him. Waiting instead was his host's contingent of gray-uniformed crew members, commanded by a human officer named Dark.
The games begin,
Vader thought, as he allowed Captain Dark to escort him deeper into the ship. The cabin to which he was ultimately led was in the uppermost reaches of the Star Destroyer's conning tower. On entering, Vader found his host sitting behind a gleaming slab of desk, plainly debating whether to remain seated or to stand, whether to place himself on equal footing with Vader, or, by appearance, to continue to suggest superiority. And then he stood, a slender, sharp-featured man, coming around from behind the desk with his hands clasped behind his back.
Thank you for detouring from your course, Wilhuff Tarkin said.
The Emperor requested it.
Tarkin pursed his thin lips.
I suppose we can attribute that to the Emperor's astute ability to bring like-minded beings together.
Or pit them against one another.
Tarkin adopted a more sober look.
That too, Lord Vader.
With a mind as sharp as his cheekbones, Tarkin had risen quickly through the ranks of Palpatine's newly formed staff of political and military elite, among whom naked ambition was highly prized. So much so that a new honorific had been created for Tarkin and ambitious men like him.
Moff.
Tarkin perched himself on the edge of his desk and smiled thinly.
Perhaps between the two of us, we can determine the reason the Emperor arranged this rendezvous.
Vader crossed his gloved hands in front of him.
I suspect that you know more about the purpose of this meeting than I do, Moff Tarkin.
Tarkin's smile disappeared, and in its place came a look of sharp attentiveness.
Surely you can guess, my friend.
Kashyyyk.
Bravo.
Tarkin activated a holoplate that sat atop his desk. In the cone of blue light that rose from it, a bruised transport of military design could be seen moving through a cordon of Imperial corvettes.
This was recorded approximately 10 hours ago, local, at the Kashyyyk system checkpoint. As you may have already guessed, The transport belongs to the Jedi. It appears to be a civilian model, but it isn't. It was hijacked on Dalalt some weeks ago, and was the object of a pursuit that ended in the destruction of several Imperial starfighters. We have, however, been successful at tracking its movements ever since.
You've been tracking them?
Vader said in genuine surprise.
Was the Emperor apprised of this?
Tarkin smiled again. Lord Vader, the Emperor is apprised of everything. But his apprentice isn't, Vader thought. I ordered our checkpoint personnel to ignore the obvious fact that the transport signature has been altered, Tarkin continued, and to ignore as well the fact that whatever codes the transport furnished were likely to be counterfeit.
Why weren't the Jedi simply taken into custody at the checkpoint?
We had our reasons, Lord Vader. Or perhaps I should say that the Emperor had his.
They are on Kashyyyk now?
Tarkin stopped the holo image and nodded. We thought they might be refused entry. Apparently, however, someone aboard the ship is familiar with Kashyyyk's trading protocols. Vader considered it for a moment.
You said that you had your reasons for clearing the transport through the checkpoint.
Yes, I'm coming to that, Tarkin said, standing to his full height and beginning to pace in front of the desk. I realize that you, of all people, require no assistance in bringing the fugitive Jedi to justice. But I want to lay out a somewhat broader plan for your consideration. Should you accept the proposition, I'm in a position to provide you with whatever ships, personnel, and materiel you think necessary.
What is the proposition, Moff Tarkin?
Tarkin came to a stop and turned fully to Vader. Simply this. The Jedi are your priority, as they should be. Certainly the Empire can't permit potential insurgents to run around loose, but... He raised a bony forefinger. My plan allows for the Empire to profit even more substantially from your undertaking. Reactivating the holo projector, Tarkin turned his attention to an image of the Emperor's moonlit-sized secret project, orbitally anchored at its deep space retreat. Vader had learned that the Emperor had placed Tarkin in charge of supervising certain aspects of construction. Clearly, though, Tarkin was angling for more.
How does my hunt for a few rogue Jedi figure into your scheme regarding the Emperor's weapon?
Vader asked. My scheme? Tarkin said with a short laugh. All right, then. Here's the truth of it. The project is already far behind schedule. It has been beset with engineering problems, delays in shipments, the unreliability of contractors, and, most important, a shortage of skilled laborers. He stared at Vader. You must understand, Lord Vader, I wish nothing more than to please the Emperor. This is Sidious's real power, Vader thought. The ability to make others wish nothing more than to please him.
I accept that at face value,
he said at last. Tarkin studied him. You would be willing to help me achieve this goal?
I see a possibility.
Narrowing his eyes, Tarkin nodded in a way that came close to being a bow of respect. Then, my friend, our real partnership is just beginning.
They're interested in knowing why you're so interested in knowing whether any Jedi were here during the battle.
Cudgel explained to Starstone and the others while the quartet of armed Wookiees glared down at them. Quickly, she made up her mind to risk everything by simply telling the truth. We're Jedi, she said, just loud enough to be heard. From the way the Wookiees tilted their enormous shaggy heads, she grasped instantly that they had understood her. The Wookiees spoke among themselves. Then one of them barked an outpouring at Cudgel.
Guania here points out that you arrive in a military transport. You look as though you can handle yourselves. You start asking questions about Jedi? He's thinking that you might be bounty hunters. Starstone shook her head back and forth.
Check the transport. Under the navicomputer console, you'll find 6 lightsabers.
Means nothing.
Cudgel cut in.
You could have taken them off your quarries, just the way General Grievous did.
Then how do we prove it? Starstone said. What do you want us to do? Perform force tricks?
The Wookiees issued a yodeling warning.
Cudgel lowered his voice to say,
In the unlikely event that you are Jedi, that might not be such a good idea out here in the open.
Starstone forced an exhale and looked up at the Wookiees.
We know that Masters Yoda, Luminara Unduli, and Quinlan Vos were here with brigades of troopers. When she saw in their deep brown eyes that she had their full attention, she continued,
We've risked a lot to come here, but we know that Master Yoda had good relations with you, and we're hoping that still counts for something.
The Wookiees didn't actually lower their weapons, but they did disable them. One of them lowed to Cudgel, who said,
Lachichuk suggests we continue this conversation in Kachirho.
Starstone asked Philly and Darren to remain with the ship. Then she, Forte, Kulka, and the others began to follow Cudgel and the Wookiees toward the gargantuan rocher that stood at the center of Kachirho Tree City. No sooner had they left the landing platform than Cudgel's attitude changed.
I heard that none of you survived,
he said to Starstone as they walked.
It's beginning to look like we're the only ones, she said sadly.
Putting the edge of her hand to her brow, she gazed up the huge balconies that tiered the tree, some of which showed evidence of recent damage.
Do you know if any Jedi died here?
Cudgel shook his head.
The Wookiees haven't told me anything. For a while, it looked like Kashyyyk was going to have its own garrison of clone troopers. But after the Sept droids and war machines shut down, the troopers decamped. Ever since, the Wookiees have been making good use of everything that was left behind.
For weapons?
You bet for weapons. Septs or no, they've still got enemies. Species that want to exploit them.
Cudgel led everyone into the hollowed base of the tree, and finally to a turbo lift that accessed Kachirho's upper levels. Similar to everything she had seen since leaving the landing platform, the turbo lift was an ingenious blend of wooden alloy, the technology that drove it artfully concealed. Covered walkways and bridges crisscrossed the tree's interior shaft, and irregular openings brought verdant Kashyyyk inside. At every turn, every staircase spiral or turbo lift stop, exterior views of the lake, the forest, and the sheer cliffs were framed by finely worked apertures and clefts. What Kachirho lacked in color, it made up for in luster and deep patina. 50 or so meters above the lake, the Jedi were ushered into a kind of central control room, which looked out over the glinting water and was perhaps the purest example yet of the Wookiee's ability to combine organic and high-tech elements. Console display screens and holoprojectors showed views of the landing platform, as well as loading operations in orbit. There, their escorts exchanged muted growls and snorts, snuffs and rumbles, with two others, one of whom was certainly the tallest Wookiee Starstone had seen.
This is Chewbacca,
Cudgel said, introducing the shorter of the pair.
And this is one of Kachirho's war chiefs, Tarful.
Starstone introduced herself and the rest of the Jedi, then lowered herself onto a beautifully carved stool built for human-sized beings. While all this was going on, Tarful and Chewbacca were being briefed by Lachichuk. Bronzium bands gathered the chieftain's long hair into rope-thick tassels that fell to his belted waist. The shoulder straps of his baldric joined at an ornate pectoral.
Chewbacca, whose black fur was cinnamon-tipped and nowhere near as long as Tarful's, wore a simple baldric Starstone thought might double as an ammunition bandolier. When everyone was seated and the Wookiees had finished conversing, Cudgel said,
Chieftain Tarful understands and applauds the courage you've shown in coming to Kashyyyk, but it grieves him to report that he has nothing but sad tidings for you.
They're dead? Starstone asked.
Master Voss was presumed killed by fire from a tank. Cudgel explained. Master Unduli by blaster fire.
And Master Yoda? She asked quietly. Tarful and Chewbacca fell into a long conversation, almost a debate, before expressing themselves to Cudgel, whose eyebrows shot up in surprise.
Apparently, Yoda escaped Kashyyyk in an evacuation pod. Chewbacca here says he carried Yoda on his shoulders to the pod.
Starstone came to her feet, nearly tipping over a platter of food. He's alive?
He could be, Cudgel said after a moment.
After the last of the clone troopers left, the Wookiees searched local space for the pod, but no distress beacon transmissions were picked up.
Was the pod hyperspace capable?
Cudgel shook his head.
But it could have been retrieved by a passing ship.
The Wookiees conversed. Cudgel listened attentively.
There's a chance it was.
Starstone looked at Tarful. What makes you think so?
Cudgel ran his hand over his mouth.
Wookiee Senator Yarua reported that rumors circulating in the Senate claim Yoda led an attack on Emperor Palpatine in the Senate Rotunda itself.
And?
Same rumor has it he was killed. Master Yoda doesn't lose,
Syadam Forte said from his stool.
Cudgel returned a sympathetic nod.
Lots of us used to say that about the Jedi.
Starstone broke the silence that descended on the control room. If Master Yoda is alive, then there's hope for all of us. He'll find us before we find him. She felt renewed, hopeful once more.
Tarful asks what you plan to do now,
Cudgel said. I suppose we'll continue our search, Starstone said. Master Kenobi was on Utapau and has yet to be heard from. Tarful issued what sounded like a sustained groan.
He is honored to offer you safe haven on Kashyyyk, if you wish. The Wookiees can make it appear that you're valued customers.
You would do that for us? Starstone asked Tarful. His response was plaintive.
The Wookiees owe the Jedi a great debt.
Cudgel translated. And debts are always honored.
A signal sounded from one of the consoles, and Cudgel and the Wookiees gathered around an inset screen. The human's expression was grave when he swung to the Jedi.
An Imperial troop carrier is descending to the Kachirho platform.
Starstone's face lost color.
We shouldn't have come here, she said suddenly. We've endangered all of you.
By the time Cudgel returned to the landing platform, the situation was already veering out of control. Blaster rifles raised and faced off with more than 100 very indignant Wookiees. Two squads of stormtroopers were deployed around the carrier that had delivered them to Kachirho, perhaps half a kilometer from where the Jedi transport was parked.
Or are you going to tell us that your weapons are all the permission you need?
A human liaison staffer was saying to the trooper's commander as Cudgel hurried in. The officer's armor was marked with green, and he wore a short campaign skirt. His sidearm was still holstered, but his enhanced voice was filled with menace.
Authorization was granted by Sector 3 Command and Control. If you have any complaints, take them up with the regional governor.
Commander?
Cudgel said in a deferential tone.
How may I be of service?
The officer adjusted his stance, readying himself for action.
Kashyyyk is harboring enemies of the Empire.
Cudgel shook his head.
If there are enemies of the Empire here, the Wookiees are unaware of them.
There are Jedi here.
You mean you actually missed a few?
The commander raised his left hand and poked Cudgel hard in the chest.
Either they are surrendered to us immediately, or we take this place apart, beginning with you.
At the commander's wave, the stormtroopers began to spread out.
Search the landing area and the tree city. All non-indigenes are to be seized and brought here.
The Wookiees loosed a chorus of ear-splitting yowls. Cudgel backed out of range of the commander's armored fist.
They don't like it when people track dirt in.
Drawing his sidearm, the commander said,
I'm done with you.
But the words had scarcely left the officer's helmet enunciator when a Wookiee raced forward, knocking the blaster from his hand and hurling him into the troop carrier with such force that the commander's forearm and elbow armor remained in the Wookiee's grip. At the same time, several Wookiee clarions roared in the distance. The troopers turned, covering one another, as the gathered crowd began to advance on them. A ratcheting noise filled the western sky. Two gunships dropped from the treetops to reinforce the advance squads, stormtroopers descending from the open bay on rappel ribbons. Rushing onto the landing platform, the new arrivals stopped short, on hearing the familiar snap hiss of igniting lightsabers. Central to half a dozen blade-wielding Jedi stood a young raven-haired woman with her weapon poised over her right shoulder. "We hear you're looking for us," she said. Standing on the bridge of the Exactor, Vader regarded distant Kashyyyk through the forward viewports. Commander Appo approached from one of the duty stations.
"Lord Vader, the conflict has begun. Theater commanders await your orders."
"Raise them, Commander, and join me in the situation room."
Leaving the bridge, Vader entered an adjacent cabin space, just as holo images were resolving above a ring of several holo projectors. Appo came through the hatch behind him, waiting at the perimeter of the ring. Members of the Emperor's new admiralty, the commanders were human, attired in form-fitting jackets and trousers.
"Commanders, I want you to position your task forces to cover all major population centers."
A holo map eddied from a holo projector outside the ring, detailing Kashyyyk and the tree cities of Kachirho, Ruwukra Oro, Kepetinochin, Okikudi, Chinachochin, and others.
"Furthermore, I want interdictor cruisers deployed to prevent any ships from jumping to hyperspace."
"Admiral Vader," one of the men said, "the Wookiees have no ranged weapons or planetary defense shields. Orbital bombardment would simplify matters greatly." Vader decided not to make an issue of the misplaced honorific.
"Perhaps, Commander, if this were an exercise in obliteration. But since it isn't, we'll adhere to my plan."
"I've had some experience with the Wookiees," another said. "They won't be taken into captivity without a fight."
"I fully expect a fight, Commander. But I want as many as possible taken alive. Males, females, and younglings. Order your troops to drive them from their tree cities into open spaces. Then use whatever means are at your disposal to disarm and subdue them."
"Kashyyyk hosts many merchants," a third said leadingly.
"Casualties of war, Commander."
"Do you intend to occupy the planet?" the same asked.
"That is not my intention."
"Excuse me, sir, but what then are we supposed to do with tens of thousands of Wookiee captives?"
Vader faced the one who had challenged him.
"Herd them into containment and keep them contained until they have accepted their defeat. You will then receive further orders."
"From whom?" the challenger said.
"From me, Commander."
Try as she might to convince herself that her actions were justified, that the clone army had become the enemy, not only of the Jedi, but also of democracy and freedom, Starstone couldn't surrender herself fully to combat. Brought into being to serve the Republic, the troopers, like the Jedi, had fallen victim to Palpatine's treachery. And now they were dying at the hands of those who'd helped create them. "This is wrong. All wrong," she told herself. And yet, clearly, the notion of tragic irony hadn't been incorporated into the clones' programming. The troopers were out to kill her. Only the flashing blue blade of her lightsaber stood between her and certain death. The stormtroopers who'd been the first to land were already dead. From blaster rounds, bowcaster quarrels, lightsaber slashes, blows from war clubs, and the occasional giant shaggy fist. But more and more Imperial craft were dropping from the wan sky. Gunships, troop carriers, scores of two-person infantry support platforms. Worse, word had it that the incursion wasn't confined to Kachirho,
but was being repeated in tree cities worldwide. If the hearsay was true, then the Jedi weren't the priority. The Empire was merely using their presence to justify a full-scale invasion. And the fact that Imperial forces were refraining from launching orbital bombardments told Starstone that the ultimate goal was something other than speciesside. The troopers had been ordered not to amass high body counts, but to return with prisoners. Starstone held herself accountable. Inevitable or not, she'd furnished the Empire with grounds to invade. Forte and Kulka were wrong to have deferred to her lead. She was not a master. She should have listened to Shrine.